In Night of the Living Dead, George Romero's 1968 horror film, corpses rose from the dead to feast on the flesh of the living.
This is the latest disclosure in a report from National Civil Defense Headquarters in Washington. It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims. It's hard for us here to believe what we're reporting to you, but it does seem to be a fact.
George Romero made Night of the Living Dead on a shoestring budget, working on the weekends. It became a cult classic and is now in the archives of the Museum of Modern Art. Night of the Living Dead had scenes that were very graphic for the time, shots of zombies munching on arms and internal organs. But in terms of state-of-the-art gore, it was nothing compared to the two sequels Romero directed, Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. Romero also directed Martin, about a teenager who thinks he's a vampire, and Creepshow, the film anthology of Stephen King stories. Romero's new movie is a thriller called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. It's about a monkey who is trained to help take care of a quadriplegic and takes over his mind as well. This movie doesn't have the gore Romero fans have come to expect. I asked him if he intentionally made the change.
That's not what I was looking for when I started the project. This was based on a novel, and I had just seen a 60 Minutes report about the Helping Hands program, which is the real-life program that puts monkeys in homes with the handicapped. And within days of that, Charles Evans sent me this novel that he had bought the rights to, and I guess because of having seen the television show, and I was attracted to it, and so I read it carefully, and then I just loved the themes that were in it, and I fell in love with the project itself, and it just really didn't call for very much blood.
But you feel like you've worked with a different set of muscles for this movie?
No, you know, it's funny. You never really get a sense of that when you're doing it. The real difference that I feel or that I felt when I was on the set was not the fact that we didn't have to, you know, buy all that 3M stage blood, but that it was just a slower paced story. The real effect that I think you feel as a director is the difference between what is an action film, essentially an action film, and this, which is a lot more subtler and suspenseful.
There's a lot of psychological suspense in it that keeps building as the movie goes on.
Yeah, so texturally, the difference is between the pace. It's the, you know, this isn't a shoot 'em up, which essentially the zombie films are westerns, you know.
Do you see this as an updated version of the scientist in the laboratory movie, you know, where the scientist is performing a secret experiment on a living creature?
Well, there's a little bit of that, and it's very hard for me to keep a straight face when I'm making a film, and so I like to sort of I use a lot of, I hesitate to use the word homage because it's been used so much, but I use a lot of references, shall we say, to other directors and to the genre in general, and so I tend to do that. I think maybe some of the angles on the scientist in the lab and some of the things that I was just doing visually to recall a more old-fashioned style of film maybe is what's making you think of that. I mean, this is a story about science run amok, I guess, but it's really much more about the result of it, than it doesn't dwell at all on the scientist or it doesn't rely the way the original Frankenstein did on fancy sequences in the lab, if you will.
Well, I don't think I'm giving away too much to say that the scientist is injecting monkeys in his laboratory with human brain tissue to see if they get smarter.
Yeah.
And when his friend is paralyzed in an auto accident, he donates one of his monkeys to a special program which trains the monkeys to assist the physically handicapped.
Right.
Now, I was really wondering, I know the monkey that you cast for this role is actually from the Boston Helping Hands program, which trains monkeys to work with the physically handicapped.
Right.
How did they react to you saying, well, we'd like to use one of your monkeys for a horror film that will scare the dickens out of anybody who's using these monkeys?
Well, this monkey is not actually working in the program. It comes out of the program.
Right.
There's an interesting story. Alice Levy, who owns Boo, who is the star of this movie, one of the stars of the movie, plays the role of Ella. The Helping Hands program actually puts their monkeys out for adoption. They're born and raised at Disney World right now, most of them are.
And what a life.
Yeah. When they're very young, they're put up for adoption, and they like people with active homes with children to take them in for adoption. And the monkey will live with someone for 3 years. This is to get the monkey used to living around humans and around a home where there's a lot of activity, to make it less skittish, to make it less afraid of human behavior. And then if you adopt one of these monkeys, you sign papers which says, I will give this monkey back, I promise, at the end of 3 years. And what happened was Boo was one of these adopted monkeys, and Alice fell in love with it and was hoping that she didn't have to give it back. And I guess we came along sort of right at the right time. The monkey got the role in the movie, and the producer agreed to replace the monkey so that Alice could keep Boo. And I don't think that Boo will ever work in the program. Boo is probably going to remain a house pet.
You have a disclaimer at the end of the film saying that no monkeys were harmed in any way in the making of this movie.
Right.
And I wonder why it was really important for you to get that on the screen.
Well, I felt that it was important. There was such a furor over Project X, and I think that people are naturally suspicious when they see an animal picture. These animals were very loved. Their trainers were their owners. They do come out of the program. The other monkeys that we were using, most of the other monkeys we were using, were actually from the program. There was really nothing going on with these animals that was in any way traumatizing them or hurting them. You know, when they... The scenes that look traumatic were done with either puppets or with, you know, some other kind of movie trickery.
My guess is film director George Romero, his new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. Okay, so what did you use for the human brain in the laboratory?
Those are things that you can buy. You know, there literally are catalogs, scientific catalogs that you can, you know, that supply things like that to.
Like real human brains?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think that was a human brain, though, but it was, I think it was...
Fooled me.
Okay, yeah. It looks real. It's some kind of brain.
You know what one of the real scary scenes in the movie is? Where the guy who's become paraplegic is in his wheelchair, and his mother comes to visit, and she's showing him home movies of when he was a kid, and there's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah, well, that's the first... I mean, that's really part of what we're trying to set up, is not only the frustration and the tragedy of having that condition, or trying to indicate what the kinds of things that you have to overcome when you... trying to put the audience in the position of experiencing enough of that to sympathize. So it's selecting things like that might be the most bothersome. And also trying to show things that the monkey could possibly help with, like when he drops his mouth stick and he mm-hmm. can't get himself a drink and can't feed himself and things like that when the monkey is introduced, the monkey can help him to do.
You know, I think an audience brings certain expectations to a horror film. When I went to see your movie, I figured, well, everything looks pretty cheerful so far. Any minute now, something really terrible is going to happen. And sure enough, before the credit sequence is over, something terrible does happen. How do you work with audience expectations in a horror film? Do you feel that you can play off of them?
Well, they're there. You know, I think that most of the people that walk into the theater have either seen the poster or seen the trailer, and they know what to expect. In a certain sense, that makes it difficult with a film like Monkey Shines, which develops slowly. There's a lot of story that has to be told before we can get down to the nitty-gritty part of the horror, if you will. So people that are coming for the pure horror experience have to wait a little longer in this film than they might normally have to do in a film of mine or in a film like Friday the 13th. This is a much more story-oriented film. It's also not that kind of horror film. It's much more of a psychological sort of suspense. It's a suspense thriller rather than a pyrotechnical horror film with a lot of elaborate special effects. It's not a particularly bloody film. It's not a bloody film at all, in fact. And it's much more of a psychological thriller. So I think with that kind of story, people are more willing to wait. I don't think that it's quite the same crowd that's coming in just for the thrill of the ride.
But you still know things are going to go wrong.
You know things are going to go wrong, and there are little clues and little hints that indicate the you shouldn't get yourself all too comfortable in your seat. But as I say, it's not pyrotechnics that you're going to experience. It's much more of a psychological, it's suspense. A couple of jumps, but it'll just, I hope, keep you wondering what's going to happen next.
You used a symphonic score composed by David Shire?
David Shire, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I thought it was very refreshing, actually, to hear a symphonic score. I have nothing against electronic music, but there seems to be this generic electronic score that is circulating for a lot of movies nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I was thrilled to be able to get that kind of score. I think David did a wonderful job with it, and he's an excellent composer. And again, the film is a little bit of a throwback that way. I mean, it has we went purposely for a sort of an old-fashioned look to it, a Technicolor kind of look, and it's in general we were hoping to give it that kind of character.
The film has a pretty surprisingly upbeat ending, without saying any more about it.
Right.
Your films usually have very bleak endings.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if this is the ending that you wanted, or an ending that was kind of agreed on with the studio, because I know sometimes studios do insist on certain endings.
Yeah, it was agreed on, not only by between myself and the studio, but it was myself and the studio and about 1,200 people that previewed the film that voted on it. And there's this new process with in the movie community, which dictates that you have to preview your film and show it to people and listen to the audience reaction cards and so forth. And I had an ending on there which was a kind of a coda. It went for less than a minute long, but it just indicated that back at the university these experiments were continuing. So it's exactly the kind of ending that you're talking about. It was not a particular downer, because it didn't affect any of the main characters. It just indicated that out there in the world that the experiment was going on, and therefore there was likely to be another problem someday, somewhere. We got a very really marked audience reaction, negative audience reaction to it, because they just wanted to sort of end the story with the characters that they cared about.
Well, are you outraged that your endings have to be dependent on a popular vote?
Yes and no. Yes. I mean, of course, I would rather just do the film the way I want to do it. On the other hand, it's you know, it's a big business, and there are people out there that are risking, you know, well, $7 million, in this case, close to $7 million to make the movie, and then, I don't know, it's probably another 7 or 10 again to put it out and make copies and advertise it and all that. And it's so it's one thing to demand creative control. It's another thing when, you know, all these, you know, there's a fiscal responsibility to respond to what the audience wants. And on a certain level, this is why it's so hard to legislate creative controls, because it really, in this country particularly, is a business. And if they can say, well, this is a business, and this business relies on so many people coming to see this, and here are these people who are indicating that they want it to be a certain way, it becomes a tough argument. You know, on the other hand, whereas I think the original ending was a little more literary, and it sort of rounded out a certain part of the story that I felt needed to be rounded out, and I'd rather have the ending on there. However, if audiences don't like it, it's a very tough decision to make. I'm not sure that if I was doing it entirely on my own and without the studio, that I wouldn't have reacted exactly the same way. Just for fear of wanting the film to succeed and wanting the rest of the film to be seen. In this case, it's also particularly difficult for me, because that ending really had nothing to do. It didn't have anything to do with the story, with the main.
Which ending? Ending or the new
Mine,
ending?
Uh-huh. The one that was taken off.
Mm-hmm.
It really is not vital to the telling of the main line story.
Right.
So, and if it was, for example, if someone said you have to change the Night of the Living Dead ending, I think that would have been I would have reacted. In fact, I did. We refused distribution by one company that wanted us to change it.
Boy, it's hard to envision a real happy ending with that movie.
Yeah, well, they wanted the guy to the last survivor to survive, in fact. I refused to change that.
Right.
But that was something that affected the central storyline. And in the case of Monkey Shines, the little sequence that we took off didn't affect the central storyline at all.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of your other movies and about your own background, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director George Romero. His new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear, and it's about a Capuchin monkey who is trained to help take care of a quadriplegic and takes over his mind as well. George Romero's earlier films include Night of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Martin. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. George Romero is my guest. Now, I presume you loved horror films when you were growing up. Did you like them because they scared you, or were there other things in terms of the mood of the movies that you liked a lot?
I liked them principally because they scared me. They were the most fun for me. I think because the things that scare me in real life are always the more realistic things, the fear that someone might drop a bomb on my head or that someone... When I was growing up, I actually went through, in New York City, blackouts when we had to close the windows and worry about air raids. And I don't know whether those were realistic worries or not, but as a kid, when we all had to run around pulling down the drapes and turning the lights off, it was a very frightening experience. And then to think that... I remember when John Cameron Swayze over the television told me personally that... the Russians now had the atomic bomb, then I knew that we were goners, you know.
Is that why there's always some newscaster telling about the latest progress of the zombies in your movies?
Probably, yeah. I have a real strong concern for what electronic media has done to us and bringing us the news as quickly as it does and not letting us sort of discover things for ourselves or allow them to gestate, you know. It's just a little too... I think it's the pace more than... I'm not saying that we shouldn't be brought the news, but it's just the pace at which things are fired at us, I think, is maybe a little too fast sometimes.
Can I read something that Variety wrote when Night of the Living Dead came out in 1968? I said, "This film casts serious aspersions on the integrity of its makers, distributor Walter Reed, the film industry as a whole, and exhibitors who book the picture, as well as raising doubts about the future of the regional cinema movement and the moral health of filmgoers who cheerfully opt for unrelieved sadism. Until the Supreme Court establishes clear-cut guidelines for pornography of violence, Night of the Living Dead will serve nicely as an outer limit definition by example." Mm-hmm. Well, did you feel when you made that movie that you were compromising your moral health or that of your audience?
I didn't feel that way at all. And Night of the Living Dead did, I think, I attribute much of its success to the fact that it was one of the films that people wrote about in those terms. The piece that you just read was one of... 100 pieces that were pleading for some sort of, that was in the period of time between the Hays Commission and the MPAA, which we have now, and there was no governing panel at all that was indicating, there was no censor board, there was no one indicating what, in any fashion, what was to be expected from the content of a film. And, you know, I certainly didn't make Night of the Living Dead for it to be showed at a kiddie matinee. And that was principally what it was criticized for. And I believe that rightfully so, that it shouldn't have been shown at kiddie matinees. That's not who the film was made for.
It's a very extreme film. I mean, I don't think ever before in a movie were zombies shown as explicitly munching on people's limbs. Did you think that the extremity of it would also help get you attention?
You know, the fact is it wasn't nearly as extreme as some of the films that had come out and been made before it. I mean, there were a whole string of films that were, you know, these ghoulie films or real splatter films that came out actually before Night of the Living Dead. They got narrower distribution and they didn't get as much attention, mm-hmm. and they didn't get the same sort of mainstream release.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I spit on your grave, I eat your flesh... Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. There was a whole wave of films that came out that were really much smaller and much more, even though Night of the Living Dead is called a cult film, it's really been seen by too many people to call it a cult film. It really was not. It came out in a very wide release initially.
Did you like all those other films that you just mentioned?
Those kinds of things, as I said, what scares me is the bomb, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I have never yet been really shocked in my heart and soul. I've never, you know, sat there with my mouth open at any effect that I've ever seen in a movie. And we consciously, all we said to ourselves when we made Night of the Living Dead is, well, let's overstep the bounds of convention and let's not cut away when the monster is about to munch on someone's arm. And so we just didn't. And there's a rather short sequence in the film that shows that. And there's one sequence that everyone points at particularly when after the two young people are blown up and burned in the car. And that's the sequence that everyone talks about. It lasts for maybe 20 seconds, and there are probably a half a dozen very explicit shots in it. It's not even Grand Guignol to the extent that the sequels that I did were intentionally sort of Grand Guignol. Those sequences were done for the sake of seeing how well we could do them and how shocking we could be. In the case of Night of the Living Dead, it really was not quite that... I didn't think it was quite that gruesome.
Well, Tom Savini, who's done a lot of the special effects for your movie, said in his book that he wasn't happy with how the 3M stage blood photographed in Dawn of the Dead, which is the second in your zombie trilogy. And I wonder if you felt that way, too.
No, I liked it. And Tom and I will always argue about it. I liked the fact that it looked comic book. Tom felt it looked too bright and red. And it didn't look real. And I feel that that helps ease the pain a little bit, the fact that it was more comic book. I like the fact that it looked very comic book.
I'd love to see some of the outtakes from your zombie movies. I figure that there's probably wounds falling off accidentally and blood spurting in the wrong direction.
Oh, yeah. Always have. We have a lot of outtakes. I wish I could have afforded to keep it together and even make a little film from some of them. It would have been great. But
how did you come up with the way you wanted the zombies in your zombie movies to walk? Did you demonstrate for them how you wanted them to look?
No, it's funny. When you have 40 people in makeup looking at you and you're trying to direct them and tell them what you want them to do, if you make the slightest little arm movement, then in the next shot everyone makes that arm movement. And so I pretty much leave it up to them and just ask them to do whatever they think a zombie might do if it had just recently come back and had stiff limbs and come back from the dead with stiff limbs. Because if you demonstrate at all, then all of a sudden you get everyone doing exactly that. And the only way that I've found to keep everyone doing their own thing is to let them do whatever they want to do.
I know that a lot of students were in Night of the Living Dead. Have people kept up with you over the years trying to be extras, trying to be zombies in your movies?
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. It's like someone wrote once that there's some kind of a cultist kind of chic to being a zombie in one of these movies. I don't know. I'm always amazed at people that call and say they want to come in and they want to be a zombie or they want to do a special kind of a shtick or a special kind of business. We haven't been able to accommodate as many people as have requested to come in. So it's never a problem getting zombies.
Now, I read that when you were 14, you were making a little movie on your own, and you were, I think, arrested for for throwing a burning dummy off a roof for your film. What's the story behind that?
I grew up in New York City, and I lived in the Bronx in a place called Parkchester, and I was shooting with my uncle's 8mm camera, and I was making a movie called The Man from the Meteor, and The Man from the Meteor was ultimately shot with his own ray gun and fell flaming off the roof of the building where I lived in Parkchester. And I set fire to a little dummy and dropped it off the roof without having failed to contact the police and let them know I was going to do this. And so, yeah, I was hauled away by the police and my parents were called. And it wasn't a serious arrest. I didn't have to spend the night in jail or anything, but I was actually taken in.
Did your parents try to put a halt to your filmmaking or did they support you?
Well, you know, when I was making The Man from the Meteor, they just thought that I was off doing, something that was a hobby. And I thought it was a hobby. I thought movies were made by, by some sort of royalty that was born into the right and privilege to make them. Or they were made by elves off in Hollywood. And when I was growing up, it really was the only place that movies were being made was in Hollywood. And when I went to Pittsburgh to go to school at Carnegie Mellon, I went to study painting and design. And at the school, which had a very active and excellent theater department, the dean at the time convinced me to transfer into the theater department, and that was the first time that I ever had any inkling that, gee, maybe there's some kind of a of a career, or these are real people that do this kind of thing. It's not anything magic. But even at that time, there was no hardware. Nobody was making films at a university. All we were, you know, a film class at a university in those days was comprised of watching the Battleship Potemkin and talking about it afterwards. there was no hardware. But some friends of mine and myself, when we got out of school, set up a little company to do commercials on film in Pittsburgh, which was, I guess, somewhat audacious. But at the time, even commercials were not being done in small cities like Pittsburgh.
You've said that you've never really been afraid of the kind of images you create. What scares you is real stuff. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, have you ever been haunted by any image that you've created for a movie?
Only to the extent that I've been typecast as someone that makes this kind of movie. And so that's a kind of haunting, I guess. But again, that's reality. That's not anything, that's not part of the fantasy. No, I haven't been.
Anything you'd be too squeamish to film?
I couldn't shoot news, I don't think. I mean, again, it comes back to that. I don't think I would want to cover Vietnam. Uh-huh. I don't think I could do it. In the context of fiction, I'm not bothered by it because I guess I feel that it's safe, and I'm always actually a little bit alarmed by the way people react to it. I'm more alarmed by people reacting violently to the violence in my films than I am by the violence in films.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been film director George Romero. His new film is called Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. It's scheduled for release on July 29th, and his other movies include Night of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Martin, and Creepshow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.